Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast.
Thank you for checking out another edition of Open Trailer Podcast. We don't require a ton of your time, but certainly some of it. And thank you for spending the next 40-45 minutes with the show. First of all, thank you for all of the great feedback with the Sanborn episodes. Extremely well received. Those guys were awesome. Trevor spent a lot of his time at Beech Ridge and had some stories, which turns out they were a touch controversial, but that was just his side of it. This time out, a couple of guys who are no strangers to either a controversy or even a fight. Guess what? We hear about both in stage number one of Cole Watson and Matt Gain. You know, they're not brothers, but when is the last time you've seen Cole Watson without Matt Gain and vice versa? They go together very well, and they were awesome guests and really glad to have them on the show. Which, by the way, the intro for this is being recorded on a Monday night, just a few mere hours before the early Patreon drop. And thank you to the Patreon supporters once again for contributing to the program, making this whole thing happen. Patreon.com/OpenTrailerPodcast, 22nd anniversary of the attacks on 9/11, and the second anniversary of the announcement of Beech Ridge's closure. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time on it today. We have covered this ad nauseum. And really, you know, it's funny. I posted something on Facebook this morning, actually. No, last night. It was a teaser for this episode. And between that and reading everybody else's thoughts today, you know, the first year cut, because obviously it was the first anniversary. You know, what's up, Brandon? Studio cat tonight. I don't know, man. It just doesn't feel like it cuts as much as it did last time around. We did an entire mini-series, a season within a season, on the closure of Beech Ridge within season two. Go back and listen to those. I haven't, and I really want to, because I'll be interested to hear the thoughts of the guest we had. And, I mean, most of the thoughts, and opinions and everything, were theirs. I didn't put too much into it. But I've certainly said my piece on it. I think that's it. I think, you know, I've said my piece, and we all have. At least my opinion hasn't changed. I was very cognizant of what I was saying at the time. There's a difference between being raw and being emotional, right? So when you're raw, you're speaking your truth, but you know you're going to probably have those feelings in a couple of years. If you're just speaking on emotion, you know, it's probably not going to age well. It's like when you get in an argument with somebody and then, like, you know, you say the wrong thing and you're like, oh, man, I wish I could take the rod and the reel and just pull that right back in. But you can't. And I wasn't speaking on emotion. It was more just like, okay, yeah, this is what it is and I'm probably not going to feel any different. And I bet you I don't. But, you know, go back and listen to those episodes. It's especially if you were on one of them. I think we hit almost every champion for 2021 who really didn't get a chance to make their championship speech. That was half of doing that whole little series. At any rate, yeah, that was then. This is now. It's 2 years after the fact, and we have still a ton of content from it. And we cover some Beech Ridge stuff on stage one of Cole Watson and Matt Gain on Open Trailer. So did you know that Cole worked for Tom Mayberry? I didn't. Not at the racetrack, but at when Tom was a driver. Also, Cole's a Ford guy. You know this. If not, you know Dave Dion is. Can you imagine Dave Dion and Cole Watson talking Ford shop? It happened, and we'll talk about that. Matt's put together a pretty interesting career of his own. These guys are huge on stories, and that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to have him on the podcast. I know sometimes when I'm trying out a new podcast, I scroll until I find an episode with someone's name that I recognize, and I'm more apt to listen to that one over someone who I didn't know, right? Once you get invested in the podcast, you just kind of listen to whoever the host decides to put on, and you know, there have been a couple of episodes where we haven't had, I wouldn't say household names, but their stories are so interesting. And those are the ones that actually get the most reaction. People were like, you know, I didn't expect so-and-so to be like that. And boy, you know what really impressed me was so-and-so's episode. So I think you're going to have that experience with Cole Watson and Matt Gaine. Real entertaining guys. I laugh my ass off. I hope you do too. Let's get to it. Stage one, Open Trailer Podcast. Races did you end up winning at Beechridge?
I don't know. We were in the 60-something range, yeah. I guess.
I know with Saturday night, you were at 50, because it was such a long time.
I got a 50. The picture of our 50th win is on the fridge. And then it was what? Can't count Thursday night.
You know? Why not? I've always thought that was a little weird.
Yeah, it was only Sally Girardi that could count Thursday night, which, hey, kudos to her, because, I mean, but...
I guess that makes sense, I mean, for the NASCAR thing. But I think that kind of diminishes what the Thursday people did.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you came out of that, you know, that Thursday Thunder series with, it was designed to bring a lot of new people to the racetrack. And then when they achieve,
Man, in its heyday, though, I mean, there was a ton of people at race there. I mean, you know.
Yeah, actually, it got to the flip side of that to where Thursday Thunder actually, if everybody could have just stayed doing what they were doing, they would have stayed.
Right.
Well, because there's a bunch of us like me. I stepped up because I had to. I couldn't really afford to.
Yeah, we had a five-year limit. You couldn't only, it was four.
I remember that.
It's actually, when I did it, it was 4 years. Once you get to the fourth year, you had to step into a Wildcat. And, well, the economics of going from Thursday night to Saturday night is almost triple.
Really? So Even back then?
Yeah, it was quite a bit different.
I mean, I showed up my Wildcat. I paid like $400 for, and we built everything ourselves. I mean, it's, you know, Cole does the same, but spend as little as you can, but still the racing tires and the gate prices and, you know, all that stuff, it was about triple the amount.
Yeah, so we're talking Beechridge's Thursday Thunder, which was, I think, the first midweek show around here in the late 90s. I mean, Thunder Road had been running Thursday nights forever, but that was their main show. I remember you and Steve Coffin.
Yeah, dude. I mean, he was my rival, really. You know, and old Steve, we didn't always get along, but I mean, he was a pretty good chauffeur. He drove a lot of crap.
Yeah.
You know, and he got it done, really. I mean, he was a good guy.
Thursday Thunder was considered the entry level of racing. And Matt Gaine, who's also on the podcast today, was talking about the economics of it and, you know, three times as much just to go into a Wildcat. When you started in 1997, Cole, how much was in that truck?
Well, they had like a $500 limit or something like that. So we had like $300 invested because they had a claimer thing.
Wait a minute. They had a $500 limit?
They had like a $500 claimer thing the first year.
Okay.
So I'm like, well.
They actually had that right up until into the 2000s. That was actually in the rule book. And I think the only car they ever, and I'm doing air quotes and that shows up well, but the only car they ever claimed, I believe, was one that Craig Smith ran. They actually claimed it and they just kind of held it for a week so they couldn't work on it or anything. Then they gave it back to him. That was the only car that ever really got claimed, so to speak.
So nobody was ever going to claim any of the crap we were running anyway, but we only had like $350 in it so that we could make money if we got claimed, you know. But
when you started, was that your first foray into racing?
That was my first foray into like driving. I was going to. Because I was helping Tom Mayberry with his stuff, you know, and I went to tech school in Wyoming. I graduated in 94, and it was the same time the Craftsman truck thing came out, kind of, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, man, truck thing's cool, man. I love trucks. That'd be awesome, you know. Mm-hmm. So when they decided they were going to do that Thursday Thunder, my uncle was actually supposed to drive it. I was just going to build the stuff because I really didn't have any interest in driving it. Then,
who was your uncle?
My uncle's is Blair Watson. He was the youngest of the three. My father was the oldest, and he was the youngest. And we kind of had this old hippie fella, Noel, that was kind of a middle uncle. He went to Beechridge all the time. Like I said, he used to take me back, you know, in high school and all that crap. So I think, and, you know, we did a few enduros and a few demo derbies and stuff like that. So I'm like, well, I don't know nothing about driving, so I'll just kind of, you know, I got a whole bunch of junk we'll put together, and we'll had somebody gave me a pickup truck, and I think he gave me $75, and we bought some motor out of this van that was in the shed and somewhere. I don't even remember where it was now.
Right.
So I got it all together, and then he just decided, he said he had health issues, whether he did or not, I don't know.
Right.
So a friend of mine from high school, his father had given me a little bit of money to buy the roll cage and stuff like that. So they thought they were going to drive it. We were going to all just take turns.
Yeah, that was a thing that Thunder was really big on, multiple drivers in the same car.
Yeah, but then once I drove it, I'm like, nope, we're good. I actually gave his father his money back, and I'm like, nah, I'll just keep driving it. And I remember, like, the first lap I made, really woozy, weird, you know, those things were really soft, and they didn't have, you know, they weren't set up, and they rolled wicked, and you're like, meh, you know.
What kind of truck was it that you ran, that first truck?
It was a 82 Ford long bed, two-wheel drive, probably had like 400,000 on it. It was a family friend that gave it to me, and he weighed like 800 pounds. He was a huge man, great guy, and that was his favorite truck.
Yeah.
So we kind of kept looking just like it was when he had it the first year.
That's still the long bed that you have now.
Yeah,
right?
I still got it.
Yeah.
We just kind of repurposed it a few times, but same truck.
Is that the one you bring around to the vintage shows?
No, the one we brought to the shows is like the last one we built. We just kind of thought, well, maybe long bed really isn't the hot setup. It was like a 250-inch wheelbase. It wasn't, but I mean, it was super long, and I was thinking everybody else kind of had, you know, Walter Black and like Speedy and
Wally Henderson.
Wally and all them guys was all running short bed pickups. Maybe we ought to have a short bed pickup.
Yeah. So yours you've always kind of stood out. You know what I mean? Like, you're running the long bed truck. The other guys are running the short bed trucks. One of the things that I remember about Thursday Thunder, the early days, was that people every single week, especially in the truck series, would roll over.
Oh, yeah.
Like, violently.
Not so bad with a big truck, but when they went to the little less tenny one, you know, the little trucks were really violent. You know, the big truck was a big boxy square. You could lay on each other and have a good time. And, you know,
that's what I was saying. Like, I don't remember you flipping, but did you ever go to the short box truck?
Yeah, we did. I built two.
Okay.
The one you're talking about in question is the second one we built. Mm. I built one. We made, what, 6 or 8 laps on it before I put it into the fence. I got a little overzealous with Steve one day, and I let him get in a bad spot, and he cogged me in down to the back stretch one time.
Hook bumpers, rear to left front.
But I did some really probably bad stuff before that, so I guess I kind of earned it. But
let's talk about that early rivalry with Steve Coffin. You know, I think, you know, when you think of classic Beech Ridge rivalries, obviously the big names come to mind, like Walston Hume and Cusack and Libby and all those guys. But I don't think that Thursday Thunder gets the credit that it deserves. I mean, it's now 25 years in the rearview mirror.
I know, it's crazy.
A quarter of a century that Sally Girardi and Laura Webster at the time.
That was a big rivalry, too.
Holy smokes.
I mean, they went at it, you know.
Yeah, there were thousands of people that did not like Sally Girardi and did not like Laura McKeag.
Right.
And, I mean, it made, you know, my job easy as a young race announcer. I just learned how to play off, like, you know, the heroes and villains off of that. But you also had one, too. You and Steve and Wally Henderson went, I mean, toe-to-toe a lot.
A lot. We all took turns being the bad guy. You know,
yeah.
I've been the good guy, I've been the bad guy, I've been the hated guy, I've been, you know, so. But, you know, Steve was probably the one that was a lot better driver, I think, than Wally was.
Mm.
You know, sometimes his stuff didn't go quite as good, but he knew how to drive it out of it. And he was, at the beginning, he was a lot further ahead than we were.
Did you and Steve always, I mean, you say you didn't always see eye to eye.
No. We do now, kind of, although I haven't seen him for years. But one of the last events that they had at Beech Ridge, the last Summerfest events, I had my truck there, and he drove it.
How much? So, why did the track go to a track tie, and when did that happen?
Well, they were like police cruiser takeoffs were the thing, and they had kind of changed to a different size wheel and tire, so they were kind of drying up. But I think it was a chance for the track to make money too.
Oh, right, yeah, exactly.
You know, was more of it. You know, because I found a place down in Framingham, Mass. I was a family friend of the guy that was in charge of the whole police force, all the rolling stock. Yeah. And I could get as many tires, used ones, as I wanted. I mean, they had a pile the size of this room or bigger, you know. We went, took a U-Haul down and get...
Yeah, U-Haul my pickup.
Yeah, yeah. So we ended up...
Tell me that story.
Well, it really wasn't. It was just like when you pulled in and like... Because every... You spent a lot of your time during the week looking for tires.
Yeah.
Hunting for tires. And everybody would say, oh, there's a mountain of tires. You know, you get down there like 2 or 3 or something like that. So we pulled into this thing and it's like...
There was a mountain of
tires.
There
was a mountain of tires. And
so you took a U-Haul.
Yeah, I rented a U-Haul. We got, what, 400 tires or 300?
Yeah, it's full, whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, all we could get.
It weren't a small U-Haul. This is like a full-size...
Had Grammy's attic on it and everything.
This is like a divorce U-Haul.
Yeah, about like that, yeah. And they were just what we needed. So we went... That year, I sold them for like $25 a piece.
Yeah.
So that year, we made like $2,500, something like that.
You know? In racing.
In the tires, just selling tires.
Right.
So the next year, they went to track tire, and I spent $3,500.
So, I mean...
Did you get rid of all those old tires?
No, there's still a couple kicking around. You know, wow. We didn't get rid of all of it, but...
Wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we went from a $25 tire that you could run most of the year.
Most of the season, yeah.
If you got one that was good, you know, they didn't wear out that much because they're radial, you know, and then went to a track tire that you're going to get 3 weeks out of no matter what you do, you know, I mean... At the time, they were probably $80-$90. They're $150 now. They're almost double.
It was kind of the beginning and the end of the truck thing, though, because like a truck, at the time, they didn't race it anywhere else, and it costs as much to run it as a street stock.
Yeah.
And now you're buying the same basic tire as a street stock, so it just kind of, people stopped building them because
street
stocks
got paid twice as much.
Yeah.
So,
Wildcats.
How long have you guys known each other?
I was 97.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, my father bought a L Model Mac off of Cole. It must have been right around 96, 97.
Yeah, it's my first truck.
Yeah, it actually was. It still says Cole right on the side of it.
Yeah, I spell almost as good as that now.
One of the things I like about this podcast is, you know, learning. You think you know a place and you think you know a person.
Right.
Matt and I have been friends for 25 years.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I obviously know you have a dad. That's just humanly impossible not to have one. But I didn't realize your dad's history at the racetrack. I mean, I knew Carl Gayne, right? Yeah. I knew the name, but I didn't realize, the amount of stuff that he had done at the racetrack. Yeah, want to expand on that a little bit?
So my grandfather, Carl Gayne Sr., owned race cars, worked on race cars, built engines. Of course, my father followed those footsteps. Mm. He owned a B-class car in, I believe, 1973 that Don Brown drove just for that season. And they kind of... I don't know if they kind of forced the B-class in with the late models, so they made a late model division. That car basically got pushed out into the woods. It's the one my father drags around to the shows now occasionally when he's not bringing the A-class car out. So my father went to – he was in the Navy at the time, so he went out and decided to build a late model. He bought that car, actually, but had Don drive it. It was 75 or 76. It was before Don won the championship.
So when do you start getting interested in racing, Matt?
He was born into it.
Yeah, ever since I got pictures of getting my diapers changed on the right front of Cliff Marine's modified, you know, back in the early 80s. I've been going there. I've been in the grandstands, you know, ever since I could remember. And then as soon as I got not quite old enough to get in the pits, we went in the pits, and I think I was 14. I had a goatee, so nobody ever questioned me.
Were you the guy in high school that people tried to buy beer off of or give you money to go buy beer?
It could be, yeah.
Yeah.
But you run go-karts somewhere, too.
Yeah, so. We ran go-karts the first year when we ran the backstretch and ran the infield pit road.
Yeah, I remember that, 92.
Yeah, 92. And then after that, we, you know, differences with the... you know, the group there, we decided to go to Unity, and I ran Unity for 2 years and won a bunch of races up there. The Unity is a fun track.
It's so weird how doesn't matter what level it is. You know, there's always some sort of like not controversy, but
we call it politics.
Politics.
There's always politics, you know, and racing, man.
You know, we have currently, you know, at the time of this recording, you know, Granite State and Pass are just, yes, you know, button heads back, yeah, and forth. And, you know, even at the go-kart level, I remember working with in the same organization you were, the SMKA.
Yeah. And, then, yep.
Yeah. So, and there was a guy, I'll never forget it, Walt Dearborn, yep, was his name.
Yeah, we actually raced as part of they called us because we, you know, had a cool name. We were the Black Demon Racing Team.
That was you guys.
Yeah, we were part of that. The biggest thing that we had against the SMKA deal is they switched from running open carts to cage carts. And, you know, I've always been a larger human being, you know. we always had issues making weight. Or not issues making weight, but we were heavy.
I just remember Wall getting mad and leaving. And I think there were a couple people who got mad. There was the Scott Lucier got wicked mad. I think even Archie St. Hilaire was involved in this too.
Yeah.
They ended up starting a go-kart track in Old Orchard Beach in the parking lot of the ballpark.
Yeah, I raced there.
And it's still there today.
Yeah, but no, we raced go-karts for a while. Then once I got, you know, bigger and older, we had to do something race car-wise. So my father gave me just an old Buick Regal, and we called up Russ Nutton. He had a cage kit sitting there on the shelf, went over and bought the cage kit and started welding it in.
What year Regal?
It was like 85, 86.
That's like the best.
Oh, yeah.
Those are my favorite cars.
Painted it black. Tried to make it look as much like a Grand National as I could because, you know, it's one of my favorite G-bodies. And that's the one that we started Thursday Thunder with.
Were you always – well, I know you were always a 61.
No, ran 38 in the go-karts. And then when I moved up to full-size cars, there was already a 38. So
that's
We had been working with, you know, all of Phil Pomelo's cars were 61. We worked with Robbie Harrison. Pee Wee Knight was always 61. And so I just kind of absorbed that.
Yeah.
And been 61 since.
Well, you mentioned Pee Wee Knight. I know a lot of people look up to him, and you know,
I actually worked for him for like 2 or 3 years.
Really?
He was my boss.
What kind of business was that?
Just basic automotive mechanic stuff, brakes, oil changes, things like that. We worked with him for one season, and actually, no, it was 2 seasons because we had one car that it belonged to Paul Bossi that Phil Pomelo owned, and it had the front clip was from distance, the center section was NRP, and the back was Dale Shaw. So the car wanted to fight itself all the time. And we run that car for the rest of that season. Gordon Nelson started the season, and Gordon just, I mean, the car was evil. It just didn't want to do anything, right?
Yeah.
And so he bought a Levitt car after that, and that car was actually pretty fast. That's the one that once Pee Wee got done in the car that Robbie won handful of races with. He went really good in it.
That was the Poland Spring car.
That was the Poland Spring car, yeah.
Cole, 45. You always been car 45?
Yeah, well, the same uncle I was supposed to drive there, he did this enduro one time, and the middle uncle that was kind of the hippie, he painted signs in the summertime, and he taught skiing in the winter. That was his thing.
Right.
So it was some big old Buick in the 60s. We were going down for an enduro or whatever, so... No, it was a Lincoln, big Lincoln. My uncle had driven it, you know, so we painted it blue, and it had this big gold 45 on the side of it, and because that was the number they gave him or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, that's really cool. And then when I started helping Tom, his number was 45 also, you know, and there was a time there where I really considered the guy a fairly good chauffeur. I mean, we were right behind him. I mean, you know, we thought a lot of him.
Tell me about working with Tom Mayberry as a competitor. There's a generation of people that don't realize that Tom raced.
Yeah, no, he was... it's funny. I talked to Russ Nutton pretty regular, you know, and we talked about it last episode, basically, because you end up talking for an hour or so. There was a time there when I thought Tom was a pretty fair chauffeur. I mean, we had one 250 that he should have won and was just too kind and ended up like... fourth or fifth, but I mean, he started outside pole and he was fast all day, and he just kind of got a little bit of a mix. There was a late race caution, and he was.
What year was this?
98, 9, 8, something like
late
that.
Late 90s?
Yeah, late 90s. he'd get tired, kind of, sort of. You know, he was pretty good size. He's a large man now, but he wasn't quite as large. But he would, you know, he'd get kind of wore out if you...
He'd fall out of the seat after a while. Kind of,
well, he didn't really fall out of the seat because there was a lot of it. But,
right, yeah. But, I mean, literally.
But he... He was really, really, one of his best things was he was really good on restarts, especially if he was on the bottom.
Yeah.
One night we were talking about this. It was him and Jerry Babb was on the outside of him there or something, and Jerry liked to lay down on you, it seemed like. Yeah. He was running some Ford thing. I don't remember what it was. But
it was a got milk car.
Yeah, I guess so. It was a dark-colored thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
So they come down for, it was a qualifier, I think, for the 250 or something like that. Jerry comes down and lays on him, and Mike just... And Tom just takes right off, right? So it tears like the the door and fender and hood and everything right off Jerry's car. And of course, then it totally screwed him for the rest of the car didn't go very good. So we were just thinking about how, you know, when Tom went, he went and that was it. You know, he was kind of on that way. But other than that, he was pretty cautious, kind of, sort of.
Back then, could you have seen him owning the racetrack?
No. No.
You didn't see that
coming? No, I didn't think so. You know, his family, I've known his family forever, grew up with his mother and father are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
God rest them. They both passed away recently. But, I mean, his family and my family have been good friends for a long time. And his uncle moved out west and had something to do with aqueducts. And they always had plenty of money to spend. But I never actually thought they were, you know, going to
buy the racetrack.
Buy a racetrack and stuff like that. Although... When the before Pass was going, they had NEPSA there for a while, and he was trying to get into that kind of sort of too a little bit. And,
yeah.
But I never really thought of him as going to be a promoter. It was kind of a surprise, but I mean, man, kudos to him, I guess. You know,
he's been at it for over 20 years.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, I know.
And 250 was real successful this year.
I think you'd have to really stumble hard to make the 250 not successful. I mean,
yeah. Well, no, there were times. I mean, when NASCAR came in, I think people forget that when big NASCAR came in, big, you know, Grand National,
right,
in like the mid 80s, and they made it like a combo race, it was the biggest thing for a kid in the stands to see Tommy Houston's car and Larry Pearson's car.
Right.
I'd only seen those on TV.
Yeah,
you know, and so for them to be in front of me at the racetrack, so that was really big for a couple of years. But I remember crewing Barney's car in 1992 or 3 when it was still a Busch North, or maybe it was a combination. I don't even know if they were doing it at that point. But there were, I think everybody qualified. I think there might have been one or two cars that went home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would have just started them anyway, but it's NASCAR and they probably didn't. But you know, the stands weren't full. The prestige had totally gone away. And it was only really, I think, I'll credit the Ralph Nason era. You know, in that same era, the late 90s, when Ralph, that to really energize that fan base into hating Ralph Nason and filling up the stands again. But there was a period where the 250 was about to fall off.
I just want to go on the record and say I've never hated Ralph Nason.
No, me neither. I've been a Ralph Nason fan for even the guy that used to run up and down the grandstands with the flag and all that crap was fine. I could
deal with that.
Old Racing Ralph was fine. He knew how to put on a show.
He was on season one, and I thoroughly enjoyed having him on there. I got to credit Pete Silver for putting that together because I was scared as to call him.
I think he's a pretty good guy. I've never really. One time we were at White Mountain because Tom's father was a huge Ralph Nason fan. So we were standing in God and Levitt's trailer. So God was there and Ralph Nason and I can't remember who else, but me and Tom and his father Roland. Ralph's going on about how he never really put the bump at anybody that didn't deserve it. You know, he's like, if you move me out of the way and go along, then we ain't got no problem. But if I catch back up to you, you know, like.
Turn about his fair play.
Yes, yeah. But one of the best pass tour races I ever saw was down to Star. Spun three times, still won.
Yeah. You know? It was like 2002, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, he told that story on the podcast.
Yeah.
And, you know, Pete gave me the phone number. He's like, here's Ralph, give him a call.
Right.
Set it up. But it was real because I grew up not only appreciating him, but also fearing him.
Yeah.
We actually have a story about like that. The first time you ever met Dave Dion.
Dion, yeah, man. Dion had come out with his book, right?
Yeah.
Of course, Matt, big Chevrolet guy, and I'm kind of a Ford guy, so, you know, but we live in harmony, you know?
Yeah. You guys are like the sheepdog and the coyote in the Looney Tunes cartoons, right?
Yeah, he kind of keeps me grounded pretty much, basically. Yeah. But
he doesn't get in fights when I'm around or something.
Not as many.
Not as many.
So
we know the backstory.
Yeah, right. So, He brought this. He was supposed to be there during one of the past 400 weekends, right? Yep. So he shows up with his book. Matt does. He's
I bought the book for my father, which my father was absolutely despised Dave Dion.
Well,
I don't really know why I bought the book, but it was one of the Coastal 181 books, and all of the rest of them have been good. The Bugsy book and the Richie Evans books are all great.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it, and I read the book and became a Dave Dion fan. So,
So anyways, there's one part in here where he drove a Chevrolet.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's like, I'm going to go down and have him sign that page. that would be a good way to piss him off. But go ahead, you know. So he comes back in about 10 minutes, and he's like, dude, you got to go down and meet the guy. That guy's awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
so I went down there, and I handed him the book and asked him to sign it. And of course, you know, he's really a nice person. He's really a good person. And he started signing it, and Bruce Bernhardt was working on the car at the time. He saw my Watson racing shirt, and he said, "Yeah, these guys, they run Fords over here, and they won the championship this year." And and if he had another gear, he found it, because he just puffed right up, and he's like, "Boy, I sure do love to hear that, you know, people taking Fords and beating them." I go, "Yeah, they even had a Chevrolet guy working on the thing." And he's like, "I'm surprised that guy didn't screw that all up." You're kind of talking to him.
So I
grabbed the book back, and I'm like, "That's cool. I mean, the guy was awesome." So I went back to Cole. I'm like, "Dude, you got to go down and talk to him. You have to go down and talk to him." Of course, we're all getting ready to go out for practice. So then walked him down there, and it's two like people, and they hit it off like they've been brothers.
Yeah, forever. Man, it was like we'd known each other forever. We started talking about motor stuff. He's like, "What are you running for motor anyway?" You know, And it was, it was like we'd known each other forever.
They called us to, like, go practice, and I'm like, "Cole, not to break up the party here, but we got to, like, go." We got stuff we got to get to work.
Well, Cole, I can appreciate that, because it's not like you get a chance to talk shop about Fords with a lot of people.
Right. Well, actually, the coolest part of the whole thing was you had to draw up a position, right? So we get ready to draw. Dave's standing there, goes, "Hell, I'll draw for you."
Wow.
"Oh, boys, I got this."
Pole.
Yep.
That's cool.
Yeah, that was awesome. I'm like, man, that was really.
So, you know, the Ford thing, I have to ask, have you ever driven anything that wasn't a Ford product?
Not till just recently. Since Beechridge is closed, we've been racing at Riverside. We call it Grove Tona. It's kind of an awesome little place.
I love it.
In the middle of nowhere, kind of, sort of. But it's a neat track to race on. It's kind of like White Mountain. We call it White Mountain's ruder but more willing sister,
pretty much.
You know? And the people there are awesome.
Yeah, the family, Humphrey family running it, they just do a great job.
Yes.
So, it's so clean, too.
Yeah, they keep it clean. My only complaint, and I told Mike this the other day, is you got about 10 minutes to get your stuff loaded on the trailer when the evening is over.
Yeah.
Because the lights are going to go off, and they're going to go drink beer.
Yeah.
You're welcome to go drink beer with them, but they're going to drink beer.
Right. So,
gotta get loaded and get out.
Yeah, you gotta get loaded and get out. So we had because the weather hasn't been real cooperative, so we've had a couple of these rain out things. So we're having this double feature thing. So we've been in this car we've had a lot of trouble with. It just don't go good. You know, this is the latest car that I built. We ran it at Beechridge some, and it's just...
It's always kind of missed something.
Yeah, there's some fundamentals about it that we're missing.
Why don't you call Dion?
Well,
I don't think anybody's really running one of these. It's an S197 chassis, and nobody's really running that around here.
Even Roger couldn't figure that out for you?
Oh, he probably could.
But we've got it. We're getting it better, right? So we go out for the... They're having a double feature.
Yeah.
So basically, it's feature, then the heat race, and then another feature.
Mm-hmm.
So we get ready to go out. He goes, "You know, we got double feature tonight. You might want to take it easy on this one."
"Whatever you do, just bring it back rolling." It was my exact words. Just bring it back rolling so we can start the rest of the night.
Yeah.
So we're trying this new trailing arm angle thing in the back, and that thing is hooking up wicked. It's the best it had gone. So I got this guy we call Yukon Cornelius, who's kind of Vermont. He's a little alternate, but good guy. And he's kind of all over the place. I get up to...
It's like your hippie Uncle Noel.
Yeah, only a lot bigger.
A lot bigger. a lot more rugged to race against. Yeah. Still a good dude.
So he's kind of... I sail her into turn three, and he's kind of up at the top of the track. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to drop down the bottom and goodbye. Well, he did too. So we end up spinning out in the infield. And like, so I'm leading the points, and I want to keep as many points as possible. So we get going again, and then now I'm at the back. I passed a few cars, and the thing is flying. I catch up with Jimmy Storrs, and he just plinks this other dude out of the way, and we go right into the fence, wide open, just as high. I've never hit the wall that hard.
Yeah, I saw that online.
I'm like, that hurt. And what really pissed me off was the nut strap snubbed right up and really pissed. Yeah, so I got out real mad.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like Ricky Bobby, only I was ready to fight instead of looking for diapers to wear.
And rolling around in the asphalt.
Like half of the pit crew was all chasing me, the safety crew to keep me from
Yeah.
So we get that all calmed down, and Costoris was pit next to us.
Had to be.
Yeah. So we're standing there trying to figure out what the hell to do. Now, we got more points we need to gain. So the track owner comes down. He basically just pats me on the back and says, quick, son, take my car.
Yeah.
He's got like two or three street stocks. He's like, I'm sure you can fit one of these. So he kind of digs out his best one.
Yeah.
And he's like, here, run this one.
To get you through the night.
Yeah. They just put a rear end in it and all that stuff just before that.
You went from last to third in the heat race.
Yeah, I got third. Kind of burned the right rear up on the feature, but I finished third.
The point of this story is that you were not driving a Ford.
No.
So how did it feel?
I'm like, man, this thing is way better to drive than the box I'm running right now. That thing's way harder to drive. Yeah, you know what was weird, though, was you pull in the victory lane. They take top three. I felt bad about not having my own stuff.
Yeah.
But I was really appreciative that I had something to race.
Right. You ever going to, but you're back driving your Ford now.
Yes.
Will you always drive a Ford?
I guess so, just to be different. Hmm. We've had a lot of fun things happen to us just because it was a Ford. And you got fans just because you're running a Ford too, And
just contrarians out there that
absolutely
love the fact that it's a blue oval.
Right.
What's the coolest thing that's happened because you drive a Ford?
Really cool people come down. Man, that's awesome. You run the Ford. We love Fords too. I think that's really great. I mean, I've never had Ford come and say, wow, that's great. You're running a Ford like that. Yeah. Whoa.
Here come the Wood Brothers.
Yeah.
I can tell you the least cool thing is every time you go through tech, we hear the same exact thing. They lift the hood. Oh, your engine's in backwards.
Yeah, because, Ford distributor's on the other end.
He goes to tech more than he doesn't, so we hear that a lot.
Right.
Same tech guy?
No, Jay doesn't say that.
Generally, the thing that always got me was, okay, so we're only one Ford, but nobody's ever really bothered to study it up enough to know what... I mean, if I was a tech man, I'd want to study up your crap just to know if I can tell if it's illegal or not.
Right, well,
nobody's ever bothered to,
If I'm you, I run illegal because I can.
That's letting out trade secrets now.
Well, most of the time.
edit.
It's no, but a lot of people, all that stuff's junk. Everybody's oh, that stuff's junk. You were never going to win with that crap or nothing. And you start beating them with it. And then, you're cheating because it's junk. You must be cheating because we're cheating and we can't beat you.
like the election.
Yeah, yeah.
What year did you win the championship in the big car the first time? Was it 2005?
2007, I think.
So that was the same year that you won the Wildcat 50. Which is what I was going to bring up.
Yeah.
So on the racetrack, you finished third. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to make sure they're trying to implement crate engines at the time. So they wanted to tear down. They wanted to tear down the top three. So I believe Brian Caswell won.
Yeah, and Steve Coffin was next to us.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So he got second, and Cole ended up third. So we all pull into the garage area at Beechridge, and they tell Turtle, Brian Caswell, we're going to take heads off.
He's we want to pull your heads off and measure your pistons and all that. He slams the hood. You ain't touching my stuff. Yeah,
he goes, yep, I'm out. And he gets in his car and leaves. So Steve actually turns to Cole and says, dude, I think you just got second. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, right on, man. Yeah.
So at the time, the engine that he'd built was he'd actually built it for Thursday nights, and at the time you could run roller valve train, roller lifters, and because you know, HO motors came roller lifter. Well, in the Wildcat, you really weren't supposed to run that, so mm-hmm. we still had that stuff in there.
Use what you got the most of, yeah. kind of a deal.
I mean, this,
you know?
Engine already, this engine already ran, and it ran yeah. good. So they said, well, we got to pull a head off. Well, he you know, turns, he looks at me and says, well, dude, how are we going to get away with...
We pull this intake off, we're screwed.
Yeah, pull yeah. the intake off. And I'm like, so I turn, I was like, can you get that head off without pulling the intake off? So he kind of thought about it for a second. Said, yeah, why not? I go, all right, we'll pull the head off. And as soon as we pull the head off, his father, Dana, was there. I said, have him just stuff a bunch of rags in there real
Ralph
quick.
Ralph had supplied us with a whole bunch of white rags.
Yeah, white rags. So, mm-hmm. so we pulled the head off and stuffed the rags in there. And we brought the head over to the bench there. And I believe it was Carl Hinkson was actually
yeah,
checking.
Yeah, he was
going
to get ready to – he's like, what? What's this cylinder head anyway? You know, he was asking about the, because it wasn't a Ford head, but it yeah. was.
Well, it said Windsor on it. So he says, just an old Windsor head. So he says Windsor right on it.
It was a World Product Windsor head. We just scrubbed the World Product pad off, you know. And then,
so yeah. he broke his valve compressor trying to get the, because it had, you know, roller valve train. You got to run a little bit extra spring. So he broke his valve compressor trying to get the valves out of it. And they measured him, whatever. Well, they measured Steve's at the same time. Well, technically, Steve's valves were too big.
He'd won the thing at a raffle or something, yeah. supposedly, was the story. You
won
know,
these heads in a raffle from, like, Speedway 95 or something like that.
Right.
And the valves were actually 194s, but they measured, like, 197 because they give you a little extra margin. And
somebody hadn't finished them.
Yeah,
know,
somebody
really.
hadn't finished them out. So, you know, they DQ'd him for it, and I turned to him. I was like, I don't think we got second, dude. I think we just won this thing. Well, they yeah. checked his valves and said, well, you got 194 valves. You can't have that because Ford's technically didn't come with a 194
right. valve. So Jody's standing there with the rule book open.
Okay.
And yeah. he says, "This is if those valves don't measure 185 or whatever, yeah. then you guys are disqualified." But he was in the limited sportsman section
oh.
and the street stock section just said must have 194 valve. That's why we were running them.
Yep.
So I'm like, hey, let me see your book. So I opened it up to the street stock page and handed it to him, and he just went, oh.
Okay. Yeah.
oh.
All right, here's your head. Put it back on. So he bolted the
yeah,
head
he
back.
Announces in the middle of the room, these fellows have found a loophole, so yeah. they're all legal, so we just stuck everything back together and like, let's get the hell out of here if we don't want to visit anymore than we got to.
Yeah, yeah.
At the time, I was, I mean, they disqualified.
Yeah, there was people like taking stuff off the trailer. I mean, the race had
Mike
been
Rowe.
Done for, yeah, Mike
the,
Rowe.
The other Mike Rowe, he got, you know, he finished like seventh or eighth, and he got disqualified for something or other. And
yeah.
Richard, like out of the top 10, I think like seven or eight people got disqualified.
Why?
Just they were finding...
I was supposed
no,
to
no,
be.
Like why? Are, I mean, yeah, why did they find so many cheaters in one race?
Well, it's,
nah, everybody
there,
did something.
There were some vague rules in there also.
Yeah,
like Richard Randall got disqualified for having two valve relief pistons, and there wasn't a rule in there. It just had to have stock, and we could bounce that back and forth. I mean, there's you know, I could tell you that four valve relief pistons actually have higher compression than two valve reliefs. The only reason you run two valve reliefs is so you can have more lift. Which we already got our cam check, you know, because I built the engine. I built the engine for Richard Randall. So
when did you start building engines?
My first engine I ever built is actually the. It turned out to be, actually, no, that was the second one. The very first engine I ever built, I actually built with Beaver Norton and Roland Junkins in my father's shop, and that was like 1991. I believe I was like 11. We built an engine.
Racing engines?
Yeah, that engine went down there. You won a couple races with it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder if that means you're the youngest engine builder at Petridge.
I doubt it. Probably my father was, because yeah. he did the same thing. You know, my grandfather taught him how to do it at the same age. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, they disqualified, like...
We were supposed to get disqualified, was it. They were just going to stop at us, actually.
Mm. Well, they kept... they didn't have a top three.
Right.
They only had him, so they kept bringing cars over there, and they kept finding... This was wrong with this car. This was wrong. That's really, honestly, the start of the crate engines for the Wildcats was the next year because they figured, well, everybody's cheating. Let's just all get them the same engine. And Yeah.
Except for us.
I'm not going to go on any kind of rant about crate engines. Everybody knows.
Well, I was going to ask you about those.
They told me I could run one. Jody's like, well, you know, you can run a crate motor in there if you want to. I mean, I'm goddamn if I'm running no Chevy motor in my Ford race car.
Yes.
Right. Well, doesn't Ford make a crate?
Well, they kind of do, but it's like a high-end kind of thing, and it's not made out of pus parts like the cheap
one. They went to, instead of like General Motors use their own stuff, Ford actually went to like companies that were building high-performance parts and put the high-performance parts in their block and went, we're good. Yeah, we like this.
We got this block. What do you got to put in it?
Yeah.
You know, because since then, we've had a few.
Yeah.
How frustrating is it to be an engine builder growing up with that talent and then over the course of your lifetime seeing crate engines overpopulate a sport that you really, really love?
What's the Sturgill Simpson song? The best clockmaker on Mars.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's.
I can see it in a way. I don't agree with it at all, but I'm.
The only issue that I have is with it right now is if you want to go ahead and you want to buy a crate engine, I'm cool with that. You can do whatever. You don't have my abilities to build an engine. That's fine. Don't penalize me. Don't make me weigh 100 pounds, 150 pounds, 200 pounds heavier than you just because I know how to do something.
Right. Mm.
That's my only real, I mean, for people, that's a great option. You know, you can buy the thing. They're expensive now. They used to be like $3,500. Now they're going for like $7,000.
But on the flip side of it, some of the engine builders have kind of brought that on their own because they were charging like $10,000-$12,000 to build a $5,000 engine. Well, it's more than that now.
Yeah, they still are doing that.
But I'm totally against. So
in some way, the engine builders price themselves out of the market.
Yeah.
Well, somewhat.
Some,
not all.
Yeah. You know, there's a certain engine builder that gets $20,000 for a street stock engine.
Wow.
I've never charged that a day in my life. I wish I could.
So, pardon me for my ignorance. When we talk about crate motors versus built motors, can you do anything to a crate as an engine builder?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. There's all. I mean, you dial in www.brzezinski.com, and that guy's got a list of cool stuff that you can do to your crate engine that will get it an extra 50 to 75 horsepower.
Basically, they just created a new parts market that they can charge a crap out of you about to make this pus motor make actual power.
So now that you got this crate engine that's all sealed that makes the same power as a built engine, that you're probably going to charge almost twice as much as a built engine just because everybody... You know, no one's going to go to a racetrack and go, hey, I want less engine. Not unless you race at Oxford.
Yeah, right.
But, I mean, there is a market for it. You know, when they came out, the first thing, actually, Richard Childress actually was one of the first companies, RCR, had low drag water pumps, low drag this, low drag that. And by the time you added everything up, you had not your engine, but all your accessories, you had like $5,000 in, you know, and just bolt on stuff. And just to save power, not make it. I mean, I don't always agree with Jay Cushman. I agree with him on crate engine stuff. He goes, you just build an engine, put a 750 on it, you're going to have more power than you'll ever need. And in my opinion, it makes the racing better.
Hmm.
You don't have, like, I watched the 250. I was entertained by it. But if I had a car in that, I don't know what I would do. I would make my rear bumper with some sort of spike in it because every time somebody gets behind you and tries to poke you out of the way because everybody's within two tenths.
Definitely not like it was.
No, you just get behind whoever's there and just kind of woodpecker them until they go up the track and go on your way. I mean, Cole Butcher's cashed a lot of checks in the last two years, you know, doing that. So
yeah, I think people get, you know, a little hurt if they get their asses whipped. So they want more parity. But then the problem when you get more parity is that everybody's running the same stuff and they're running the same time. And that's why you get, I think, a lot of the big wrecks that we have because everybody's just got the same amount of power.
You can't really
go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, you know, it's like being on the main turnpike or any big highway where you have like three lanes of traffic. Yeah, they all may be going 75 miles an hour, but it doesn't really look that entertaining because they're just all running the same. No one can go anywhere. Yeah, they're gridlocked.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. And, of course, when somebody gets an advantage, like, I mean, not to bring up Cole Butcher again, but he was significantly faster than everybody else. I can guarantee you that there's something there.
Yeah.
I mean, your car is going to get you some of it. His talent's going to get him a little bit. You know, I mean, you're not going to tell me that all these drivers are, you know, one driver is that much better than everybody else. You know, it forces your hand into doing something, you know, outside the box to make that all, you know, to make your car better. No one wants to show. When I tow into a racetrack, I don't want to tow into a racetrack knowing that my car is equal to his. I don't want that. I don't ever want that. Why would I want that? I want to have a better mousetrap. So I'm going to build my own stuff to, I'm going to be, you know, I only got so much talent. He may have more talent than I do. Well, I'm going to have more car than he does.
I told you it was going to be a good time. Cole Watson and Matt Gain are back for stage number two next week, where we get into...
Yeah, so then the best part is Lewis's, whatever the hell that a**hole's name is, Lewis's half-brother or whatever he is. Perry's half-brother.
Mike Ramsey.
Yeah. He comes down and he's standing on the fence. I'm getting out of the car and he's like, you're a deserve that. I'm like...
Right in front of your girls.
Yeah, right in front of my kids. So some dude just takes off and starts chasing him up across the grandstand or whatever. I'm good enough for the guy, you know? I'm like, why the would you do that, you know?
Right. So that's next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. Thank you for your support. My name's Andy Austin. Get you next time.